This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Lydon. The summer of 1967 is often referred to as the longest of the long, hot summers. Race riots swept through 163 cities and towns across the country. Sharing the headlines with Newark and Detroit was a town of just 13,000 on Maryland's eastern shore called Cambridge. It was here that small-town life, small-town attitudes, and small-town troubles would intersect with national politics at the highest levels. President Kennedy, Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy, and Governor Spiro Agnew would all become involved, as would the black militant H. Rapp Brown. And the struggle in Cambridge would shape American law and politics. It's unsettling to find that the main street in Cambridge is called Race Street, although the name has nothing to do with ethnicity. Still, it divides black from white. On the one side, you see a picturesque harbor, a town square, and a courthouse. Cambridge is the seat of Dorchester County, the birthplace of Harriet Tubman, and it was a stop along the Underground Railway she founded. The county is a place with a long civil rights history. By 1967, there were about 2,000 or 3,000 blacks living in Cambridge. But while there were a few black policemen and a black alderman, it was a deeply segregated town. Inez Stafford Grubb grew up here.
My entire school life was in a segregated system. And of course, we lacked a lot of things. Whenever we received a textbook, it was a used textbook. And there was always a slip in the inside cover, and it was always completed with the names of white students by the time we got it.
Sylvia Windsor is a white copy editor at the Daily Banner. She's lived in the area all her life.
We used to come in town on Friday nights when we lived in the country. And one side of Ray Street was for the blacks, and one side of the other side was whites, and they never crossed over, and we never either. And you grew up accepting that, you know. I was never prejudiced, I don't think. My family wasn't. My mother and father both worked alongside of black people in Phillips Packing Company and shirt factories and wherever they went, so I wasn't taught to be prejudiced.
Russell Smith was mayor in Cambridge from 1953 to 1960. His memory of race relations is nostalgic.
In my home, we had a lady who was a cook, and she had her room in that house. And she lived with us, and she was black as she could be. And that's when I was a kid. I can remember every night when I went to bed. My father would say, "All right, it's time for you children to go to bed. Kiss your grandmother, kiss your mother, kiss Annie." Every night before I went to bed, I kissed her goodnight.
But change was coming to Cambridge. Historian Peter Levy has written a book about the town called Civil War on Race Street.
Unlike the rest of America, Cambridge was in a pretty poor state in the early 1960s. They had had a very large employer, a packing company, that had collapsed in the early 1950s and was really a shell of itself by 1960. So there was really very high unemployment by 1960 standards. And then somewhat by accident, Freedom Riders showed up in the town in early 1962. And that catalyzed 2-3 years of a very vibrant civil rights movement. And this included protests in the streets like in other communities, mass meetings, political activism, and confrontations between whites and blacks who chose to defend themselves when whites challenged them. And ultimately, the National Guard was brought in and stayed there for over a year.
Gloria Richardson emerged as the black community's most important leader. Her family was from the Cambridge black establishment and owned a drugstore and sent her to Howard University. Back in the 60s, she was attracted to the increasingly radical Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC.
Because they moved into communities and talked to people and showed them how to organize in the nonviolent tactics. And part of what their success would be, as far as the national office was concerned, if the community began to support them. So they came in and organized the high school and grammar school students who for about 4 or 5 months, with their parents backing them, shut down the town, really, at that point.
They shut it down with demonstrations, picketing, and sit-ins. Cambridge resident Lemuel Chester met me at the nerve center of this activity.
And this is the historical Bethel African Methodist Episcopal Church where I was a member for 40 years. And this is where we would come back after demonstrating, "We shall overcome, we shall overcome someday. Oh, deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome someday."
The church would just be packed, and the pulpit would have people in it, and people would just be standing all around, taking up just about every space, some sitting on the floors, some standing in the vestibule with the front door open because they couldn't get it in, and of course the balcony would be loaded with people.
That was Inez Stafford Grubb, who's now an associate pastor at the church. But the civil rights protests organized at Bethel Church didn't always end peacefully. White police attacked the demonstrators, some blacks committed acts of vandalism, and both blacks and whites were arming themselves and using those weapons against each other. Luckily, no one was killed. Alarmed at this situation, so close to the nation's capital, both President Kennedy and his brother, Attorney General Robert Kennedy, intervened in Cambridge. RFK summoned activist Gloria Richardson and white community leaders to Washington to try to arrange a truce.
At that time, the Kennedy administration was going around the world talking about, you know, democracy in America. And they really didn't want anything right next door to them. And by the second year, the national press was there. And it was in the papers almost every day. And that didn't look very good. And I think that's really why Bobby Kennedy got involved. Although I think after he got involved, he began to equate that with how they had treated the Irish when they first came to America in terms of being poor and stepped on. And we went back and forth to the Justice Department negotiating. First time I saw him, he was in an open shirt, and I think she knows, and I just thought he was just some clerk in the office. Then when he went in and sat behind the desk, we realized, you know, that he wasn't just a clerk.
Bobby Kennedy suggested the town adopt an equal rights amendment to its charter. It passed through the town council, but Richardson urged blacks to boycott the referendum on it, knowing it couldn't survive. The next year, the Federal Civil Rights Act became law. Across America, there was agitation for equal rights in jobs, housing, and schools. By 1967, Gloria Richardson had moved to New York and met the young black militant, H. Rapp Brown. She invited him to visit Cambridge and give the stump speech he'd been delivering around the country.
"We say to these leaders, how can you tell black people to be nonviolently and at the same time condone the sending of white killers into the black communities? It's something wrong. We are going to control our communities by any means necessary. We built the country up, we'll burn it down." You can quote that. "I say violence is necessary. Violence is a part of America's culture. It is as American as cherry pie."
Lemuel Chester met Brown on the night of July the 24th as he came into Cambridge from Washington.
He got in town about 6:30 or 7, and he gave his speech right across the street from where we're standing on the corner of Pine and Cedar in front of what was then the Sinclair Pharmacy. He got on top of a car and gave a speech for about an hour and a half. And the speech was, freedom is not given and that you have to take it. He said, if Cambridge don't come around, Cambridge needs to be burned down.
A few blocks away, says Lemuel Chester, shots rang out. A white police officer was hit by a ricocheting bullet, as was H. Rapp Brown.
And it was going to be a showdown. And a showdown ended up with shooting. And I mean shooting, just like a war. And Rapp Brown got shot over top of his fort. And we were able to secure a way to get him out of town. He's gone. He's gone. Nothing to do with the fire. He's gone.
That fire was the blaze that someone started at the Pine Street Elementary School. It spread, but the all-white volunteer rescue fire company, citing fears of being attacked, refused to go into the second ward and put it out. Inez Grubb and Lemuel Chester.
I remember I was running late going up there, and my girlfriend came to my house. She said, Inez, the whole second ward is burning. So I left right away, and when I got up there, everything was ablaze. They got the school and the Elks home because it was jumping back and forth across the street there. It was devastating.
And I've never seen a fire like it before in my life. The fire went from one side of the street, it hit these wires, and it burned all the buildings on that side and two or three buildings on this side, and I think it even burned this Elks Lodge.
The firemen were refusing to come out, so the men finally convinced them to let them have a fire truck. Now you can imagine men never being allowed to join the fire company, trying to get one fire truck with all of this fire, all of these buildings starting to burn. And it was hurtful and frightening to see these men on this truck, inexperienced men, trying to get the water out, but they got the water finally coming through the hose, but it was too late then.
The blaze had consumed two square blocks and more than 20 buildings, including the school, a church, and a dance hall, whose owner, ruined, committed suicide soon after. Within hours of the Cambridge fire, federal authorities launched a manhunt for H. Rapp Brown, who was charged with inciting a riot, rioting, and arson. The white political establishment and the nation's press fingered him. The morning after the fire, Maryland Governor Spiro Agnew broke off his vacation and rushed to Cambridge. He said of Brown, "I hope they pick him up soon, lock him up, and throw away the key." Historian Peter Levy takes up the story.
Spiro Agnew, who was the governor of Maryland at the time, was vacationing in Ocean City, which isn't that far from Cambridge. And he immediately comes to the town and holds a news conference. And yeah, you know, he reaffirms that Brown is the cause of this riot. Gerald Ford, who was Republican minority leader at the time, is in part responsible for adding an amendment to the last civil rights bill known as the Brown Amendment or Brown Rider that made it illegal to cross state boundaries to cause a riot.
Several historians see Cambridge as a turning point for Agnew, who had enjoyed some black support before then. He went on to take a tough law and order stance against rioters the next year in Baltimore, and that caught the attention of Richard Nixon, who would choose the Maryland governor as his running mate. Historian Peter Levy says Cambridge had significance that went far beyond the career of Spiro Agnew.
I think from the broader picture, what made Cambridge significant was that there were lots of people, not just, say, people on one side of the political spectrum, who believed that in one way or another there was a connection between radicalism or black power and urban rioting. And here they had the smoking gun. Someone had delivered a speech, called for people to burn things down, and a fire and a riot took place. And afterwards, most people didn't pay that much attention to the details of the exact sequence of the events.
On the 28th of July, 1967, just days after the Cambridge disturbance, President Johnson convened the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders, better known as the Kerner Commission, for its chairman, Illinois Governor Otto Kerner. Johnson initially believed outside agitators, even foreigners, were to blame for the riots. But the Kerner Commission found that the problems were homegrown. It would famously conclude that America was moving toward two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal. A staff report from that commission, leaked to the Washington Post, said what happened in Cambridge was never a riot at all. The report blamed the white police chief for letting the fire burn. While it may be emotionally satisfying to think that Brown came and that therefore there was a riot, the report said, and it may be simpler for the public to grasp, the facts are more complex and quite different. A good deal of the difficulty stems from the strong segregationist attitudes held by local officials. The report went on to specifically blame the police chief for a, quote, emotional binge and a desire to kill Negroes. Somehow, news of this finding never made it back to Cambridge. While the report confirmed what blacks already knew, to this day, most white people in the town believe H. Rapp Brown was to blame. Bob Parks runs a barbershop on Gay Street, right on the old demonstration route.
We had a problem here for years, and it was people they brought in to bring trouble. We were spotted as one of the towns. It wasn't many local in it. The black and white here get along, except for troublemakers. And that's, they target this town like they did down south. Had some instigators and Rat Bound, Gloria Richardson. They outshot both of them when they come in town. I shouldn't say that, but they were come here to cause trouble. Most of our local people, we get along.
But Sylvia Windsor worries that the 1967 strife still taints Cambridge.
Well, the legacy is it painted us and made us look like one of the worst cities in the United States, and I don't think that will ever go away.
But Cambridge has moved on. Today, when most Americans think of the riots of the summer of 1967, they think of Newark and Detroit. Few people remember Cambridge, Maryland. The newest big thing is a Hyatt Hotel and some hopeful tourist boutiques along Race Street. But if you go there and ask Lemuel Chester or anyone else from the Second Ward if it's really different, well, he gives you this answer.
We still have a white Elks, a black Elks. We still have a white Masons, a black Mason. We have a white American Legion, a black American Legion. So, you know, that speaks for itself. You know, in the county courthouse, you can go in the county courthouse now, go through the various departments, stick your head in. You'll see who are in there, and they're Caucasians. And I guess in a nutshell, yes, it has made some progress. Rosy-dozy? I don't think so.
We left Lemuel Chester and Inez Grubb, where we met them at the Bethel Church, and she plays the organ. Our story on Cambridge was produced by Rachel Guberman. The recording engineers were Drew Reynolds and Kurt Stalnaker. The editors, Martha Wexler and Alice Winkler. This is NPR News.